The opening words will be spoken today by Carolyn.
Learning to love is why we are here on earth. It means expanding our circle of care and compassion beyond our family and friends to all living beings, to all of creation. Learning to love is a long and winding pathway and a source of all meaning on this earth.
Now we have Carolyn read the story for all ages. If the kids in the audience would like to come up and be read to, please come up.
Okay. So this story is called A Little Child Can Show Us. And actually it's a true story. And we wanted to learn about what little children would do if they saw someone who was sad or hurt or crying. As most people thought that young children would not care about someone else or try to do anything to help them, because a lot of people think that kids are more like little devils. Yeah. Okay. But people were wrong about that. And so this is a story about a little girl, and her name was Julie, and this is, as I said, this is a true story, and she was just 18 months old. And that's not, I mean, she's just not much more than a baby herself by then, is she? I mean, because she's only been walking and talking herself for a little while. And her mother was a very busy woman, and she had several other children, and she also took care of others, people's kids. So one morning, a neighbor came over and asked if Julie's mother could take care of Brian, too, while she ran some errands. So the mother did that, and the house, it was a small house, and it was just packed with babies and young children. And Julie's mom was kind of a no-nonsense kind of person, and matter of fact, and she could take things in stride. But today, she really had her hands full. So after the neighbor left, baby Brian started shrieking at the top of his lungs. And Julie's mother tried to calm him down, but he just got more and more upset. And she thought it might help to, the mother thought it might help to put him in a high chair and give him some cookies. As soon as Brian started to cry, Julie looked very startled and worried, and her whole body tensed up like she was really scared herself. But she didn't run away. Instead, she went over and reached out toward him. And then he just threw the cookies on the floor and started crying some more. Julie carefully picked up the cookies and tried to give them back to him. Remember, she's just a year and a half old now. And the mother was surprised by this, because usually Julie would try to eat everyone else's cookies. And then the mother put Brian back down on the floor to see if that would settle him down, but he just kept crying. And Julie kept hovering over him and whimpering a little bit herself. So then the mother put Brian in a playpen, but that didn't help either. But still, Julie just stayed there, right by his side. Then she gently stroked his hair and reached into the playpen to pat his shoulder. The mother left and went into the kitchen. From there, she could hear Julie cooing at Brian, to Brian, making these kind of sympathetic sounds. But the crying still didn't stop. Finally, Julie came into the kitchen and urgently pulled her mother back into the living room. So she was not able to help herself, so she went to find somebody else to do it. She took the mother's hand and tried to put the mother's hand on Brian's head. Now, sadly, because the mother was so busy, she really failed to appreciate what all the different things there that the child had tried to do, this little 1.5-year-old. So young children like Julie taught us that they're not just concerned about themselves, and they're not just little devils. They also care for others in need. And she was still like that 5 years later. And it seemed to come from deep within inside her. So she showed as much sympathy as grown-ups do, and more than some. So I think that that's a good lesson for us all to remember. Do you know kids like that that like to try to help? And is that something that you like to do? Well, that's good. That's good. So, do you have any questions or? Okay. Well, that's the children's story for today.
Thank you so much, Caroline. Well, 2 weeks ago, we had a presentation by Morris Waxler, who talked about compassion and empathy in the non-human, in the early humanoids. And all this is about is we keep on having talks and presentations about peace and our goals for peace and our objectives for peace and the people doing wonderful things for peace. But I'm a recycling kind of guy, and people talk about the wonderful things that are going on in San Francisco, and I say, well, that's fine and good, but what is going, if we can't make it work in Pittsburgh, it doesn't mean that much. And so I keep on trying facts on the ground. What can we do to actually palpably change the way human nature has been unfurling in an undesirable way? In terms of real things that can be done is what keeps on driving me to bring things to the service. And I think about, in a very simple sense, watching our kids, just the simple fact of the using the phrase, use words in the schoolyard, and the power of impacting kids at an early age in developing a sense of empathy and whatnot, has been a very powerful tool. And I keep on exploring and finding out who can bring us more things. And one of the most powerful things we have here in Madison is Davidson's Center on Brain Research. And we have very fortunate here to have Caroline, who works at that center. Imagine a couple, power couple we have here in terms of Morris and Caroline. It's Wisconsin's answer to Bob Dole and Elizabeth Dole without the Viagra. Anyway, I'm very much looking forward to Caroline's talk. And again, we have a mock-up in the, and maybe it's my fault, in the order of service. The title of today's talk is The Origins of Compassion in Humans. Caroline is currently a senior scientist at Richard Davidson Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at the UW, where they conduct research on mindfulness, kindness, and compassion. She has been featured in articles about her research on empathy in the New York Times and elsewhere. And as she's coming to the podium, I'm going to pass out one of the articles so you can take a look at it. Please, I'll leave a few copies, share with your neighbor. Caroline, please welcome Caroline Waxler.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you for the invitation. It's very good to be here with you today. So, compassion is defined, I suppose there are more definitions, but a general basic definition is that it's considered to be a deep awareness of the suffering of others and a desire to alleviate that suffering. It's grounded in empathy, or these feelings of concern for the well-being of others. So when I look to history to get some better sense of these ideas, I turn often to Adam Smith and Charles Darwin. These men spoke of far more than self-interest and survival, those ideas for which they are better known. And more than 2.5 centuries ago, Charles Darwin, Adam Smith, in his book, The Moral Sentiments, described empathy as the ability to understand another's perspective and to have a kind of emotional or visceral reaction. Now, modern science has the means to measure how we can literally feel what others feel. The neuroscientists speak of something called emotional resonance. And in neuroimaging studies, they can map out those parts of the brain that light up when someone else suffers and that also lead to our caring actions. Adam Smith believed that we were born with natural empathy, that our concern for others is essential to morality, and that it's the glue that holds societies together. Darwin shared these ideas. He thought that sympathetic kindness increased through natural selection, and that communities that included the greatest number of sympathetic members would flourish best and raise the greatest number of offspring. In Darwin's book, The Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals, he provided a richly detailed description of an empathic facial expression in his 6-month-old son's response to a nurse who was pretending to cry. And about tender-heartedness, he wrote, "The feelings they call tender are difficult to analyze. They seem to be compounded by joy, affection, and especially sympathy. Neither of these men would have been surprised by Julie's actions and probably would have been delighted." There have been other points of view, of course, sometimes and often predominantly so, and sometimes very rancorous debates about the essence of human nature, as if there could possibly be just one essence. So what sets Smith and Darwin apart from other theorists, I think, was their ability to fully grasp our multifaceted nature. They understood us in our remarkable complexity, all of our inner demons, which we just saw, as well as our inner angels, which is the topic for today. Most philosophers and theologians viewed people as driven primarily by their own interests and needs. These views made their way into 20th century theories of psychoanalysis, psychology, biology, and evolution, and all were opposed to the idea that genuine concern for others could be a central goal of human behavior. Young children were viewed as selfish, egocentric, demanding, and lacking in the cognitive ability to discern another's needs. None of the developmental theories would have predicted the early appearance of concern for others when we first started to study it a few decades ago. But as they say, fools rush in, and we were ready for the venture. There was already by then ample anecdotal evidence based on informal observations of young children, and I will talk more about that work a little bit later. But first, I'd like to consider the relevance of empathy and compassion in our own lives in order to place the research in context. In recent years, we've seen an outpouring of interest in these topics. We seem to hunger for knowledge of how to promote compassion and caring amongst us humans. This is part of a call for fundamental change in how we relate to others, as families, friends, strangers, cultures, and nations. Scientists, religious figures, and spiritual figures, community leaders, and social activists alike have turned their attention to the nature of concern for others and how it might be fostered. It's even entered the world of politics. In 2008, Barack Obama campaigned on the importance of promoting empathy for the welfare of our children and nation. Hubert Humphrey once said that the moral test of government is how government treats those who are in the dawn of life, the children, those who are in the shadows of life, the sick, the needy, and the handicapped, and those who are in the twilight of life, the elderly. One of our UU principles is to promote justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. We are far from alone in affirming the value of compassion. Variants of the Golden Rule are found in all major faith traditions and have long been part of folk wisdom as well. You don't need to be religious to practice the Golden Rule, but one challenge is how to put these principles and values into practice, and another is to practice them by skillful means. Buddhists distinguish between compassion and what they call idiot compassion, which is not helpful. It can actually make things worse for the victim, for the helper, or both. Karen Armstrong, a former nun and major religious scholar, recently published a book called 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life. Working with leading thinkers from a variety of faiths, they established a charter for compassion. It's an effort to restore compassion to the heart of religious and moral life and to counter extremism, intolerance, and hatred. The charter has gained traction, as have a number of other programmatic efforts to inculcate kindness and generosity. Several years ago, the Dalai Lama posed a challenge to Western scientists. He said, "If your science can disprove my beliefs, I will give them up." Now, the Dalai Lama is a wise and clever man. He knew full well that science has its own limits and could not provide unambiguous disproof of his beliefs. His challenge, I think, was actually intended to promote dialogue between Eastern and Western traditions, between science and religion, bringing empathy and compassion to the forefront. This led to fruitful worldwide conferences and collaborations and a burgeoning of research on practices intended to enhance well-being and compassion. Neuroimaging studies show differences in brain activity in the scans of Buddhist monks experienced in meditation practices with those of novices. Meditation has been shown to produce changes in brain activity that are linked to greater joy and compassion. When I retired and we moved to Madison over 10 years ago, I went to a talk by Sharon Salzberg at the First Unitarian Society in Madison on the practice of loving kindness or compassion meditation. It is intended to access the human heart's source of energy. It is said to reduce feelings of isolation, to awaken compassion, even for those who hurt you, to find freedom from needless self-created suffering, and to learn to trust your own loving, intelligent heart. There was a time in my life when I would simply dismiss such ideas out of hand. But when I heard Sharon Salzberg speak, her words rang true and drew me into the practice. We begin by befriending ourselves. Often this is difficult because many of us have had so little experience in doing so. Also, friendship is usually seen as a relationship with another person, not with ourselves. In meditation, we learn metta phrases, and metta in Pali means loving kindness, that we silently extend first to ourselves. There are simple phrases. These are intentions. May I be safe? May I be happy? May I be well? May I be peaceful and at ease? Other phrases may be substituted, but the idea is simply to affirm an intention for our own well-being. The kindness that we grant ourselves is not the unhealthy self-regard that swells the ego, nor is it sentimental and soft. Befriending ourselves is about true self-acceptance, when we can begin to let go of the inner critic. It is about being gentle rather than judgmental. It's about genuine self-respect. One power of the practice is that it allows us to nurture ourselves. The other is that it helps us to forge broader and deeper connections as we extend our intentions toward others. We move from caring for ourselves to caring for a favorite person, a mentor, or a family friend, or a close friend. We begin to widen our circles. Next is the neutral person, someone we don't know well and don't feel strongly about one way or the other. It can be surprisingly difficult to find that neutral person, for evaluation is also part of our nature. Then comes the difficult person, which is really, really hard. Next, classes of individuals, and finally, all sentient beings. Increasingly, scientists are studying the impact of such practices on well-being, be it physical, mental, emotional, personal, or spiritual in nature. And some of this work is, as Peter noted, being done at the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at UW, headed by Richie Davidson. One aspect of work at the center considers and includes intervention studies. There is a study of preschool children that involves a loving kindness curriculum. When I first heard that they were doing that, I thought, well, how can they do that? And when I saw the curriculum, I understood that one simply needs to adapt the practice to be age appropriate, but it's something that can be taught and learned at every point in development. So just as when one is doing loving kindness meditation for oneself, these intentions are translated into ways that that young children can understand. School-age children also learn meditation as a means to heighten attention, increase empathy, and reduce bullying. So there's another intervention study that's being done that involves preschool children, school-age children, and now adolescents. Empathy and bullying are seen as opposites. Whereas empathy is identifying with another person, feeling what they feel, bullying has been seen as the hallmark of repressive regimes and individuals seeking to impose their will on others. Throughout history, this has been so. In Mary Gordon's book, Roots of Empathy, Changing the World Child by Child, she describes a program to foster empathy in children. She has mothers bring their baby into a classroom, a school classroom, over a period of time so that they can learn to appreciate the baby's feelings and accomplishment. Babies are small and powerless, a condition that can overwhelmingly elicit empathy. Children who have been part of this Roots of Empathy program show less bullying, more cooperation, and more emotional understanding than children not in the program. The title of the children's story today, A Little Child Can Show Us, is a riff on the biblical story, A Little Child Shall Lead Them. Here our protagonist is not an extraordinary being who changes the world. It's an ordinary child who does something remarkable in her everyday life. The beauty is that young children have this capacity. The problem is that parents often fail to see it. I've seen a youngster show concern for someone else in distress, while at the same time the mother is saying her child doesn't show it. Compared with children's quarrels, conflicts, and fears, compassion is a more quiet response. And it's interesting to me that in this Smithsonian article, which is on morality, which is about compassion and caring, that they choose to present on the cover the little demon, showing what they are not talking about rather than what they are. And partly I think that this is because it's very hard to convey compassion and empathy with the same kind of drama of the boldness of the devil. Compassion, it consists of subtle facial expressions and gestures, soothing words, and gentle acts. And this is no less true in the world of adults, that we pay less attention to the good deeds of others. Or let's say simply, the media pays less attention. So what's brought into our world daily is mostly all of the horrific and negative acts that are conducted in the universe. Now, Julie represents the high end of early empathy in her persistence and her concern and the many different, ways in which she tried to soothe the baby. I mean, there were at least five or different things that she had done. So this is a very complex, complicated response. Now, the more cynical among us might say that Julie simply wanted the crying to go away because it upset her. And she wanted to feel better. And this is an argument that's often made about why there can't be something called genuine concern for the others. But if that were the case, she could have just left the room. Also, her actions spoke otherwise. Her tender engagement with the baby is a shining example of moral action. It embodies the core of compassion. She showed a deep awareness of the suffering of another and a desire to alleviate it. Many children do not show this much empathy, but most show some. So this may be the first and most important lesson for adults. If we can see young children as having these qualities, it can alter how we respond to them. They are socially competent, emotionally attuned beings in several respects. I've had an abiding interest in the origins of empathy and compassion, having studied it for decades. I actually started this research in the 1970s, and the fascination continues. I'm still working in this area, and the other day I was helping some students, graduate students over in child and family studies at UW, and we were looking at videotapes of children showing concern to someone who was showing distress. And it's each time I see another face of a young child showing this, I take as much delight in it as I did decades ago. There's something always new and refreshing and wonderful about it. So over the course of development, or over the course of time, we've studied its development in over 1,000 children, beginning in the first years of life, and others have done these kinds of studies now too. And we've studied the infants and toddlers into middle childhood and adolescence. Recently, we found that concern for others, this kind of empathy, is present in infants even before the age of one. They're not yet old enough to help, like Julie did, but those babies who showed more concern when they were younger in that first year were also more likely to help later when they were Julie's age. So these kind of empathic feelings can motivate helping, caring acts. Children are more likely to, you could say that these caring actions do increase with age, the behaviors, the helping behaviors, and so do the cognitive abilities of being aware of what's going on in the other person, so that more physical and mental skills are developing over time, which increases the possibility of showing more caring behaviors. But what doesn't change with time is the emotion, the tender feelings, the concern. It's there from the start, and it doesn't grow with age. I think if we stop to think about that, I mean, do we think that adults show more empathy and feeling than children do? I would say probably not. So it's not developmental in the same way, and it's a kind of a sort of a beautiful but very fragile quality. And so you can imagine that under certain conditions or certain circumstances, it can become dampened or exploited or even snuffed out. Studies by others have also begun to identify other aspects of children's emerging moral sense. Infants in the first year of life have conceptions of fairness, equity, and justice. They prefer helpers to hinderers, the good guys to the bad guys. And all of this research is described in the Smithsonian article, which gives an excellent account, and I would recommend to people in this work on what they call the new science of morality, just kind of look past the baby devil. So lest you think I paint too rosy a picture, remember, I did not say that children are this way most of the time. And yes, they prefer the good guys to the bad guys, but they can be tempted by the bad guy. Temptation also is a part of life, and it is there right from the start. In the parable of the Good Samaritan, the helper responds to a stranger in distress. Studies do show that we're more consistently inclined to help those that we know where we feel most comfortable. This too begins in the first years of life. It highlights our tribal nature, which limits but does not preclude our ability to reach out to more distant others. Again, Julie has something to teach us. Brian was not part of her inner circle. Children are known to help strangers, just not as much as people they know, again, like adults. There are increased efforts to teach tolerance and acceptance of diversity in school classrooms and the workplace. Some of the projects I talked about earlier tried to broaden children's view of who needs care. For example, children that they don't know, or look different, or are picked on. There are many barriers to broadening our circles of compassion, but it can be done. Childhood is a good place to start, as the beliefs and values and habits are less ingrained, the alternative beliefs. Kindness and concern for others are traits. Some show it more than others. Most any parent with more than one child will tell you that some are more difficult than others. The child who is by nature calm, contented, and caring of others is easier to handle. Care for, excuse me, they're not dogs, or horses, or what. We want our children to be kind and generous, to cooperate and share. Studies show that a number of parental practices are associated with these behaviors in children. It may be no surprise to parents that parents who show concern for others, both in principle and in practice, and who are kind and caring toward their own children, are the most likely to have children who also show these qualities. It's about walking the walk, not just having a conversation. It's about consistency and a spirit of generosity with each child, even as children differ in their desires and demands. Perfect parenting is neither possible nor something to strive for. Even if we were able to do everything right, whatever that means, positive regard for others cannot inevitably be created in children. And this is where child temperament comes in. Scientists now study the interactions between nature and nurture. Sensitive parenting requires adaptations to the different needs of the children. Some parents who have a more difficult child decide that the child is at fault and there's nothing that they could have done. Parents also show preferences for a particular child, and rejection is surely a deterrent to empathy. And as I've also become more and more aware of recently, the favoritism is really no favor to the other child. Judith Harris decided that she had no influence on her children because one was perfect and one was deeply troubled, despite her perfect parenting. So the child had to be at fault. Harris went on to write an influential book claiming that children are socialized by their peers and not their parents. Her evidence was weak, but she found a receptive audience. And there is much that parents can't control or influence. But to flatly state that they have no influence, period, is simply not correct. Contrast this with the response of Jane Brody, who writes about health and wellness for the New York Times. She wrote a column on ways to encourage empathy and caring in children. She told me that when her twins were born, their personalities were very different. One was easy, the other difficult. Both are now caring persons as adults. Jane soon realized that they needed to be treated very differently. Essentially, one required much more soothing, nurturing, attention and guidance than the other. Different approaches are sometimes required to obtain similar outcomes. Parents typically have to figure these things out on their own. Some have good intuitions, but much of it needs to be learned, and there are precious few teachers. Grandparents and older relatives are less often nearby than in the past. Parenting classes and programs are more prevalent than before, but they're only a partial substitute for the support and wisdom of others who've been through the process. Some parents face daunting challenges. In his recent book, Far From the Tree, Andrew Solomon writes about parents whose empathy and compassion are truly tested. Their children have conditions that, for quite different reasons, impair emotional connection and communication. Some children have developmental disabilities or mental illness. Some were deaf, or dwarves, or criminals. The parents interviewed spoke of both the difficulties and the joys. They had much to overcome in dealing with children who were so very different from themselves. Love and compassion played a role, and simply determination to hang in there. Solomon's book is well worth the read. There are many obstacles to widening our circles of compassion to include those who are different or difficult. Cultural differences also create barriers. Daily, we face questions about our responsibility for others in our society. What is our role as private citizens in caring for others in need? What is the role of government? How can people in different countries learn to respect and care for one another? One summer project in New York brought together Palestinian and Israeli youth with this goal in mind, and it succeeded. But when they returned to their homelands and countervailing forces prevailed, mostly the progress that had been achieved was undone. Despite inevitable setbacks, there are reasons to be encouraged. One is the increase in leaders who promote cooperation and compassion. The other is the recognition of these potentials in children and fostering them. Transformation is possible, and through the small steps of many, perhaps we can reduce suffering on the planet, or in Mary Gordon's terms, changing the world child by child. May it be so. I think that some, and there are studies to support that, but that some of the learning is through the modeling of others' behaviors, and that's why when I spoke about parents who model these behaviors, that's another kind of source for the child to learn. So you can predict and also perhaps since this mother was doing a lot of child care, you could say maybe she had ample opportunities to observe this. And yet this particular mother, as I said, she was very matter of fact, no nonsense. She was not, you know, I did not view her as an empathic mother, and this is where the kind of interaction of nature and nurture come in. So it's a way to learn, but I also think that some of this it comes instinctively. And there are even studies, these just amazed me, that are studies in utero of twins where they've been able to record the actions that the twin directs toward itself versus the other twin, and even in the womb they see something like these almost like patting gestures. I mean, I think it's inherent in our nature to be social and to reach out. But there are sex differences. You don't as often see boys taking on this role, though it's not that certainly that they never do, and that there are different kind of ways in which boys and girls show their concern. Boys often will, their empathy, the feelings are less difficult to see. You don't hear them cooing as much. They get more involved in instrumental actions, which is sort of true of sex differences throughout all generations, that there's this sort of this with males being more agentic and instrumental and problem solving, and females showing a kind of a greater variety of ways of coping. I mean, I know parents when their kids were around that age who was really upset because the child didn't seem to be showing enough concern. And so
yes.
That's why I emphasize most children don't necessarily do it most of the time. Most adults don't necessarily do it most of the time. But it's like if you see the potential there, it's something that can be fostered.
Well,
but you don't also want to go overboard and be kind of almost like demanding it, which is what I see in some parents, and that's pretty overwhelming. So a couple things come to mind here, actually several things. All mammals, I think, have that capacity, the mirror neurons, although it hasn't been studied in all mammals. But there's a distinction that some of the leading neuroscientists I know, one is Jean de Saty at the University of Chicago, and they do imaging studies of children and adults. And there's something called the pain matrix in the brain. And what happens in when someone is exposed to someone else's suffering, parts of the pain matrix light up in the brain. Not all of it, not the part where that light up when you yourself experience pain, but the part that lights up when someone else vicariously experiences pain. But that's all part of the pain matrix. And he would take issue with saying that's mirror neurons, because mirror neurons are measured, they're like single cell recordings that show that you can elicit or that they reflect when someone imitates someone else, that that's reflected at the level of a single cell. But that's very different than this more broadly based affective resonance. So some people will say, yes, mirror neurons are an indicator of empathy, and others will say, no, it's just of a matching response. But regardless of what you want to call it, there is ample evidence that there are places, you know, in the brain that are evoked in many, many mammals. And yes, your dog does have empathy. But I'm reminded of this was, I don't know, well, Morris, if you were here when he spoke, he talked about Franz de Waal and all of his work with primates. I actually visited him one time it's called Living Links, and observed the chimpanzees, and he and I were up in an observation tower observing the chimps, and there's one that is particularly fascinated with Franz, and she wanted his attention, kind of a younger one, and he wasn't giving it to her, and because he was talking to me, and the little chimp just started to have fits and was really distressed, and several in the community of chimps rushed over to her and consoled her. And so, like, when he talks about consolation behaviors and says, chimps show this, I mean, I've seen it. The first time I met him was, he had come to NIMH and we visited there, and he had been taken by a description that I had given in a symposium on animal welfare, and I was, you know, giving and talking about how because we had some data on how young children treated animals and compassion versus cruelty in animals, and so I was giving some examples of that in the chapter or article that went with that. And one of them is the way we study empathy is now we have someone simulate pain or pretend to cry or pretend to be sad, and then we can record what the child does. But in the beginning, we had mothers give us their observations of this. So we had lots of mothers' observations. And in one that I started the article out with, there's this example of the mother or an experimenter pretending to cry, the kid sitting there just kind of oblivious, and the dog kind of rushes in to comfort the mother. So, and he loved that example. So, yeah. there. And I've heard stories about cats coming, like when someone told me that her friend was too sick to get up to eat, that the cat actually brought Chow up to the bed. Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it has its limits in what it can provide. But yeah, there's, well, and also there's studies that show, when they talk about pets being good for physical health, about the calming effect of cats, but not dogs, I'm told, in reducing blood pressure. The scientific community is very keen on trying to foster this kind of information, and they're going to be putting together a special issue of a journal called Developmental Psychology, and the call is for people to be, you know, publishing research and writing articles about what fosters compassion and empathy in children. So it's on the way, but I mean, think of how long it's taken us to get even here. When we started studying empathy, and this was in the 1970s, we could not use that word. It had a very bad connotation, and it's hard even to remember that now, but it was more thought like mind reading and paranormal activities, because how could somebody get into your head? And we had to find just a very different language to even talk about it. You know, and the display rules in different cultures, so that, for example, my belief is, and of course I can't prove it, that this capacity for empathy is almost universal, to varying degrees, and that it has been there throughout history. But cultures vary so in terms of what they permit, what they allow, what they discourage, that we see tremendous differences. It's like you try to find that place, and obviously there are heinous acts that you can't accept. But even if you think about Nelson Mandela and others who have been tortured in prisons, I mean, what has allowed them to survive is to try to understand their captors better, and to try to relate to that. I mean, people. I remember Sharon Salzberg talking one time about being in the Soviet Union and being a guard who was being, you know, very nasty and controlling and not violent, but, you know, really difficult and very, very angry with them. And she said, I mean, at first it intimidated her, certainly, and it was frightening. And then she tried to visualize or realize what it must be like to be living inside that body, in that brain, in that reptilian, you know, brain. And it just, it helped her. Because I think one of the things that we do is, like, we automatically discount people who, you know, are violent, and that's a whole other very complicated story, and that's something that we've studied too. These children who show, as opposed to concern for others, something called disregard for others, and they're callous, and they may laugh at someone else in distress, or they may hit them, or they may be contemptuous and judgmental and say, "Well, you should have been more careful." You know, or, you know, and one of the things we, in our studies, that we've shown that children who show that trait when they're very, very young in the first years, and there are relatively few of them. I think that that's another thing that's very encouraging, that a lot of what is being done that's horrible and heinous and aggressive and cruel is, to an extreme, is being done by relatively few people in the universe when you think about the size of the population in the universe. So there's a small percentage of kids, but they go on to be antisocial in childhood and adolescence, and we can trace that, you know, way back. And then you can start to look at, well, why were the children like this young, and what kind of interventions can you be doing with children? So no, I can't solve the problem of the world and, you know, offer solutions to world peace. But I, But, you know, my, as a developmentalist, I start young.
Start young.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We greatly appreciate you coming.
Thank you.
And the closing words will be Carolyn, Two Wolves, a Cherokee legend.
One evening, an old Cherokee told his grandson about a battle that goes on within people. He said, "My son, the battle is between two wolves inside all of us. One is bad, is anger, jealousy, greed, fear, guilt, false pride, and ego. The other is good. It is joy, peace, love, hope, empathy, generosity, and compassion." The boy thought about it for a minute, and then he asked his grandfather, "Which wolf wins?" The old Cherokee simply replied, "The one you feed." Both good and bad, as described by the Cherokee, are part of our human nature. Nature needs to be fed, to be nurtured and nourished, to bring forth our better selves and to reduce suffering. Those inner demons are yet another form of suffering that call for compassion toward ourselves. May we seek and find it within.
Please greet your neighbor empathetically and go forth in peace. Thanks so much.
Well, you're very welcome. It was fun. Yeah.